Where is my clubhouse?
How long do I have to answer this? If I start with, for my life, I've had a bit of trauma when I was young. I don't think the family would have got through it if it weren't for the clubhouse.
And then these people act as like the scaffolding of security. We all do act as that for each other, I hope.
The clubhouse is just the environment, not necessarily a place.
What's lovely about that little WhatsApp group is that we can share, you know, stories, we can share things that make us laugh, you know, frustrations.
It's like being around people that are going through similar things or that just understand and are just there as like a bit of a shoulder to cry on or someone to like big you up.
Like my family, the people who support me, my wife and my twin daughters. Like my wife's unbelievable for me.
Hello and welcome to the Where's Your Clubhouse podcast, brought to you by Speakeasy Club. Now, my name's Simon Clark. I'm founder of Speakeasy and also host for this very first series, and I am super excited. Now, the Where's Your Clubhouse podcast, we sit down with some incredible people, predominantly involved in the world of sport. We talk through their life stories, really. We talk about the good, the bad and the ugly. And we ask everybody that one question. Where's your clubhouse? Where's that one place for you that you can be the best version of you? You can not feel judged. You can just feel happy and you have a bloody good time whilst doing it. It's incredible to hear some of the responses, and it's a question I don't think we really spend a lot of time asking ourselves, really. So I can't wait to share some of the responses. Now, we couldn't be here without a brilliant, brilliant partner in Mentality Clothing. I'm so excited to join up with two young lads who are sharing a passion, creating a community, investing finances back into a brilliant charity in Mind Cymru. But they developed this incredible clothing line, which is cool, it's fun, it's accessible. They do big sizes for big chaps like myself. And they are just two really, really good guys trying to give back to the community. So we're delighted to offer Speakeasy 15% off. Check out their website, www.mentalityclothing.co.uk. Honestly, there's some really cool stuff on there, so please do check it out. Now, before I get into it, please, it's so important that we get your feedback on these things. Who do you want to see? How do these conversations go? Is there anything that lands with you guys? That's where we want to be, and try and pull out some of the tricky stuff as well. And hopefully there's some really relatable bits in there too. We'd love to hear from you. Please leave a review. Please leave a comment. Please share it with your friends and family. And we'd love to hear your feedback. You can follow us on all good social media platforms and some rubbish ones at Speakeasy Club 1. Now, let's get into the latest episode. Without further ado, sit back, relax, and let's find out where's your clubhouse. Mr. Di Flanagan, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Really appreciate your time. Let's just kick off. Let's get into it. So take us right back to the beginning. Where did you grow up? What was the family life like? And where did it all begin for you?
Yeah, so I'm a Gwent Valleys boy. I'm from the Rumney Valley. Grew up in Devon Engard. One of five brothers, the oldest of five brothers. Dad, who played rugby since he was a kid. So I grew up in a rugby club. It felt like most of my life, if that makes sense. So started when I was five. I think one of my earliest memories was being hit in the face with a ball. And my dad jokes that I probably didn't go back for a while. And then went back, it's 5.5, 6, and that was it. Then I was hooked. But just my like childhood memories of going down the club on a Saturday, watching my dad play, play myself mini rugby on a Sunday. But we quite routined in our life. So whether that's with the food we eat on certain nights of the week, or like Thursday night was dad's training night. So we'd go down a club with dad and watch him train and go to the clubhouse, play snooker, darts, And then Friday night, Mum would have the bingo. So we'd stay in the house with Dad, watch the rugby. I think it was Quantum Leap was a favourite TV show. He'd make a curry very regular, and we'd have a cousin over with us. And Saturday was a day out down the rugby club with when my dad played, and I jump on a bus with him. I go to any away games, some tough places. Sometimes end up in an ambulance at the end of the game. I remember one in Kevin Forrest. I think he broke his ribs playing, and he went off in the ambulance, and I had to get home with family and stuff. But Sunday then would be myself down the club, and we'd spend all afternoon then Sunday afternoon. Down the club watching football, just socialising. But yeah, as a childhood, that was quite routine, other weekend sort of work.
Obviously meant quite a lot, and as a family unit as well. How important was all that time with your dad growing up at the club and ultimately being around that rugby environment from such a young age?
Yeah, it's all I know, if that makes sense, but I wouldn't change it. So a lot of my friends, all school friends, but all rugby friends, they're my closest unit. And what's really good now is like you lose touch as there's different career paths take you different places, and we're all busy. Mm. And now just reconnecting with a lot of friends who I haven't seen for a while. So my boy Roderick plays rugby on a Sunday, and the last couple of Sundays he's been away, but we go back to the club on Sunday afternoon, and all my mates are there coaching the under sixes, sevens, nines, tens, all around his team, and just reconnecting. Amazing. With friends who I've grown up with till I was like 21, 22, and that's brilliant. And you know, with being one of five boys, you're very active as a family, and you can't do enough. Mm. And like we reminisce as well. It's quite interesting. We're all giving time back now to the local rugby club, giving time back to the community. And I avoid coaching, but I'll try and help out as much as I can because I coach every day. So I just want to sit at the back with an umbrella or that man, watch them all enjoy themselves and express themselves. But we talked the other day, and back when we were kids, it was just my dad. Every team seems to have now four or five coaches, where when we were growing up, there was one coach every Sunday, no matter how hard he did the night before, no matter the shape he was in from playing the day before, every Sunday he was there. And you kind of take that for granted when you're growing up, but reflecting on it, it's very special, the time he put in.
Absolutely. What, I mean, what sort of influence did he have on you then? Because clearly it was such a massive part of growing up, but the way you talk about him there, your father was quite an influence both on and off the pitch.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing others talk about my dad. And he's very much like we weren't allowed to kick when we were young, and he was coaching, kicking was banned. It's strange all there. And as I got to senior rugby, I love kicking and I really enjoy the kicking game now. So whether I've gone a bit that way, but he was very much go play, express yourselves, pass, find space. But also he laid the foundations for enjoyment. So whenever I speak to players who've been coached by my dad as a kid, and even my younger brothers who were coached by him, or the youth team that he coached at the time as well, it was all about having fun. All about like you turn up no matter the score, you give it everything you've got. There's not many rules, but one is when you turn up, you give everything. So he'd only really criticize me if I weren't working hard enough. He could live with a bad pass, but the commitment had to be everything. But I think that goes for life then, doesn't it? If you're going to stick at something, you need to stick at it. If you're going to try to be the best at something, you need to be thinking. And he's drilled down to me. I got some, hopefully I'll share along the way now, but one of the best life lessons I ever learned was off my dad. So I'll share that as we get through this, I'm sure.
Perfect. Yeah, that's, and we haven't rehearsed this, but we are definitely going to come on to that. So that fits in really, really nicely. So appreciate that, and I'm interested to hear a bit more about him for sure. After the ball hitting you in the face incident, when did you get back? When did you get your boots back on? How old were you? And did you look back after that time, or what was that journey like for you?
The family would say it took me a year, but I'm pretty sure it went a year to get back. But after I laced the boots back, I never looked back then, if that makes sense. I played Sunday, I'd play for two teams for my age group, and I'd always help the age group above. So I always tend to steal an extra game every Sunday, which probably helped in my journey and my development and having it tough playing up an age group. But we're all there to have fun, and we can help out. And then I stayed with the Penalty Rugby Club until I was 16. That was my club. That's the club my boy will play for until he's 16, I'm sure. And This club my uncle's played for, but I've moved a little bit further up the valleys now, but my rugby club, and it's probably the same for everyone, I reckon, whether your club is your club, isn't it?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. So turning 16 then, you said you had to, you know, that was your club until then. What was the next step on the field and your playing journey?
It was quite disjointed at that transition time, if that makes sense. I was an older age group from my year, so at 16, I played under 16s. I was pre-Christmas, which put me sort of, as I turned into 17s, I was under 18s. So I played one youth game for Penalta from memory. Up in Bargo, that was fun, pretty tough. Played a game for Newport one in Penzance, and then I went to Pontypridd under 17s, and that's where I sort of stuck. But that year as well, my first year of sixth form, I transitioned into senior rugby because I was an older under 17s, and long after I played for Pontypridd senior, so it all, that transition was quite sticky to where I found the next club. But when I got into senior rugby, obviously I stuck with Pontypridd and that club then for the next foreseeable future. But it was, it was interesting. Like, I didn't get to experience what a lot of people talk about when they say the youth rugby is the best time of their life. I didn't really experience
right,
that.
Okay.
I would say I experienced it from the outside when I was younger. So the local youth team, Penalty youth team, had a group of players who, when my dad was finishing play, and I'd often jump on a youth bus as like a 12 to 15 year old and go and watch a youth play with one of my uncles or one of the coaches. And that group of people I still stay in touch with, Martin and Richard Rowe, from the club, but there's a guy called Stuart Rock who's living out in Bayonne now, who I've stayed in touch with and I stayed in connected with throughout the time. And Matthew Tucker's, played for the club, coached the club, now back coaching the under, I think it's 12s or 13s at the club. But that youth team, I could name them all, Hugh Stevens, Gareth Rutter, they looked after me every Saturday, and I loved watching how they were enjoying their rugby, very much in the mould of Penalty, so no kicking, probably never produced an outside half at that time. They had very, very talented outside half in Mark. Arguably one of the best outside halves, ball in hand, that the club would have ever produced. For Newbridge a bit, who would openly say didn't like kicking, but it was because that's what the club was. It was about going out and playing.
So I'm really interested just to explore that a bit more. You say you didn't really have that, the youth team was your happiest time, and it's something that you do hear quite a lot, and I've had experience of talking to people that's regardless of who they've played for, the honours they've won, etc. But you kind of did have that. You just had it with a different age group and a different relationship. Did you miss out on playing in those years, or was that transition to Pontypridd seniors, was that the next natural step for you?
Yeah, I think I was very ambitious once I played for Wales under 16 schools, and my next target was Wales under 18 schools and Wales under 19. So I didn't really notice at the time, if I'm honest. I loved being ambitious, loved trying to achieve excellence. I found something I was good at, and the family made sure I was on the straight and narrow to work hard at it, because again, it goes back to if you commit to it, do it properly. I wouldn't reflect on it as something I missed, purely because I was in that moment. I was striving to be the best I could at that time and play the highest level.
So how about the next steps? Where did that go? Because I'm really picking up, and what I'm fascinated about is that whole commitment and that ethos you've got, really, around committing, being the best you can, being ambitious. So how did the rest of your kind of playing career pan out from there, and we've talked a lot about those coaching influences, which we'll come on to in a moment, and was that ever a thought at that point in your head that you thought one day I want to be on the touchline, or was it just playing that was your focus?
Yeah, playing was always my focus. I loved the idea of teaching. That was something I grew up with, an ambition to give back and teach, and I'd always be curious of how people got messages across, how they would try to engage the... we're all different, aren't we? So you have your sensible guys at the front, and you have your people at the back who are like, I don't really want to pay attention. And how they try to engage the group and get the message across to everyone. So that always intrigued me. But it was interesting. I was at Pontypridd when the Celtic Warriors started. So I was with the Celtic Warriors Academy. And then headed up to be on a development contract with them before they collapsed, and moved aside, and then I didn't have a pro contract. I went and signed semi-pro for Pontypridd, semi-pro side back there, while Cardiff were adopting the Valleys. Didn't have an academy slot, so I had to train on my own a bit while I was in university, and then quickly got drafted into Cardiff Academy because I was selected for Wales 19s, and from there followed the Cardiff Blues Academy into transit development and senior group. So a little bit of a setback potentially that did inspire me to want to make me work a little bit harder at that point in my career. But also, it's not bad to have them setbacks. You find that it can drive people. And one of my coaching things I always think about now is, how can you control setbacks for youngsters? How can you make them want that thing a little bit more?
So I'm going to throw that back to you. So you asked that question. What would you say if we were on a coaching course now with a group of under 15s coaches? What would you be kind of saying to them, advising them? We're dealing with 14, 15 year old players.
The one of the biggest things I really enjoy at the moment is how you can make people self-reliant. So I think when you're dealing with 14 to 16 to 18 year olds, give them problems to solve. Give them tasks rather than tell. Let them search for the answer because they'll find their own way. But the sooner they understand how to figure things out themselves, the sooner they'll problem solve on the field. And I'm a big believer in that now, with whether he's coaching a 36-year-old or an 18-year-old, that when they're on the field, they've got to solving problems themselves. And we have meetings daily, and it's interesting watching the South Africa thing with the traffic lights this World Cup. And it's a probably philosophy do I have. If it is, I don't know the total reason behind it. One could be potentially where they go post or corner, but you know, my belief is you need to teach these guys to make decisions in the moment, because I was an outside half who was on the field, and it was my game. I made the calls. Whatever the coach prepped me to go on the field, but I live and die by my decisions. And I want to give that leadership and philosophy to my leaders on the field. And I said to them multiple times, and if they make the wrong decision when we review it, it's my fault for not teaching them well enough. Not their fault for making the wrong decision. Because the better I teach them for feel of the game, understanding the momentum and the flow of stuff, the better they'll make these decisions in the moment. Hopefully Rhys Patcho won't mind me saying, like, I run water on a lot for Patch when he was at the Scarlets as the outside half. And one of my pet dates was, if he'd ever ask what I think or what the coach thinks, he'd be like, you're the frigging outside half. Make a decision.
Yeah. Is that something that, so when you were playing, did you kind of have that? Or is that something now as a coach, you're thinking this is an element of your game when you were playing, you didn't have that autonomy? Or were you kind of, no, this is what I'm doing, this is what's happening, and you believe that's the best way moving forward?
It was definitely, when I was on the field, they were my decisions. That's so I thought, and I probably played it just the year of mics and messages, and so there was a lot more trust between coach and decision maker on the field at that point, because you were on your own a lot more. Now you've got those who are mic'd up, two water boys who run water on, but they're used as messengers, and it can become crowded and take away player development and player leadership and ownership of the decisions.
And what it's really interesting, because there's obviously philosophy for you that you're really clear in that kind of autonomy and self-guided decision making, which is fascinating. Give us some insight into who were some of those coaches for you during your career that you really resonated with, and any particular advice during your playing career that stands out for you.
I think I was lucky along the way to have a lot of good coaches. I thought Rob Howley was really good, because I didn't play much at Cardiff. Initially, I had to earn my stripes, and that was by running the oppositional team. But he would task me to do something to help the defence, my kicking game, and I'd run away with it and lead on it and get the training team prepped. And that gave him, I'm pretty sure, the trust that when injuries happened, he was comfortable to put me in and run our game plan. And I enjoyed, and I still do enjoy, the conversations I have with Rob about rugby now. And then when I moved down to the Ospreys, I had Scott Johnson, who would sit behind me constantly in sessions and question why I was making decisions. What did you see? Where's the fullback? Where's the winger? What picture? Why have you done that? And I really, that was another evolution for me, is like immediate feedback. Again, it got me thinking, not just making decisions because it's always what I know, it's making decisions on things you see and the consequence of it. So him and Sean Ollie were real good for me down there during that period. But also even at my semi-pro level, having Paul John as a coach, who's a great rugby mind, and he's out in Hong Kong now coaching. That constant rugby conversations of a really high level, engaging about the game and evolution of the game and what can be done different. And I was really fortunate to have them guys.
So what about that move? When was that? Because for any semi-professional, but professional player as well, there'll be that point where you think maybe it's time to take the next step in the career from off the pitch. What was that moment like for you? And just talk us through how the decision to go into coaching kind of came about.
So what the Ospreys done really well for me personally was they made a decision whether they were going to keep me or not early. So I knew before Christmas of my end year, I knew I had a kick in my contract that was probably going to outweigh my value for them. So Scott Johnson sat me down before Christmas, which is never nice because it's Christmas, but he was very honest and gave me 6 months to plan what the future would look like. So he basically said, there'll be no plus 1 year. You need to make a decision now on what you're going to do. And he said, I'm here if you need advice. And I had a young kid, Avery, was only... What was Avery? So she would have been 3 months old, maybe, something like that, 2 months old. So I had a decision to make. Do I go and... I've exhausted Wales, and one of my reflections now stepping out of rugby into coaching in this career is probably I didn't fully, after committing to development and getting to that stage of a regional player, I probably sat on my laurels a bit too much. I wish I kept that edge, that drive. I probably didn't commit hard enough to the off-field diets, the gym work. I loved the game, so whenever there was a ball involved, I was on. But it was the stuff that now when you're coaching, it's easy on pitch, you see pictures, how much work you're willing to put in the evenings to analyse and help your players develop. Mm. And it is really interesting, like I'll speak, when I went back to coaching, I made sort of a promise to Kat, because one of the reflections I have, Catherine, my wife, from playing was I regretted I probably didn't commit fully hard enough, long enough. So I cut a bit of corners with my poor diet. But then on the field in games, when you run in and play in with ball, I was always on. But she made sure that I left rugby to go into a teaching sort of director of rugby in a junior school role, but then made a decision to go back into rugby. And we sat down and she said, you better bloody commit, make a promise to me, because I don't want you regretting this moment. And I have, and I haven't cut the corner in 10 years. I've gone above and beyond, and I'm always seeking advice, feedback, whether that's filming my meetings, filming my feedback sessions, constantly getting feedback of others on what I do well, what I can improve on, where are my blind spots. And it's probably doing her head in now because I've made that promise and she never sees me. So I'm always seeking to be better as a coach. Whereas potentially as a player, I could have done that a bit more. Sorry, go back to the Scott Johnson comment. He sat me down early enough. It was a couple of opportunities to leave Wales and go play in England, but not really at the highest level, or it was find a new career. And I knew I wanted to go into teaching, so I'd done a PSET to teach in college, teach BTECs, MBQs. I knew that was a route I wanted to go in, potentially lecture in some universities on some stuff. But he said something that was really intriguing, that your career will find you. And I've heard a great saying off Brad Moore lately as well, since he's gone back to New Zealand, one of the Scottish boys said something like, if it's for you, we'll find you. And it sort of found me, this role appeared. It wasn't initially what I was looking for, but it kept me teaching some MBQs, teaching some BTEC sport, setting up a junior academy in a high school to get something off the ground. And it built up and it's still going strong with Rob Sidoli as the head of rugby now. But it captured me. It got me. I have a massive respect for teachers now, having seen how tough it is for them. Hard profession. I personally don't believe the teaching schedule allows teachers to plan and prep enough to be the best they can be. They have an expectation they do in the house. They're not paid great. They've got to take a lot of issues on with them to prep for the day after. It has to be done the night before constantly. I think my bias, I think the teaching profession could learn a bit off other professions and provide teachers a better opportunity to better themselves. They work extremely hard. They have a lot to deal with, teachers. they probably aren't given the fairest opportunity to do it. But a lot of it comes down to cost, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. There's a few bits there I want to come back to, but I want to just dial back slightly. Excuse me. When you talked about that moment, you sat down with Scott Johnson and the words you used, you know, rested on your laurels, didn't really commit to the nutrition and the off-field stuff. Just, it's interesting that conflicts with the committed to doing the very best you can in everything you do piece. And then straight away, as soon as you come into the coaching, it's like, right, this is what we're doing and we're committing. Was that a big lesson for you then, thinking about what you could have done?
Yeah, it's the biggest learning I've had, if I'm honest. And you see players now, and the advantage I potentially have as a coach is if I see players cutting corners and know how they're doing it, because I was arguably that person. And it's a regret. It's most certainly a regret, because who knows how many pro games I could have played more? Who knows the level, like how longer I could have played? But I did love my career and I love playing. And I would play rugby 3 games a week. I didn't have much contact, bear in mind, but I just love the game, love playing. It's the other stuff that and it goes back to like the pretty stuff now is coaching your boys. The tough stuff is done when no one's watching. I'm really committed to that.
You could just tell by your smile on your face that playing the game was just a massive part of what you loved. And the other bit then, going into the teaching aspect, clearly you're a student. You're a student day to day, whether that be in the classroom, in your previous career, or now as a head coach. But what was your first coaching role? What did that look like when you kind of went into that role?
So I have a couple of... One of my first ever coaching role, I coached my brother maths tag team at under sevens. So I'm one of 5 brothers. It's me, Dan, Luke, who's unfortunately not here no more, Math, and Josh. So Math's under sevens team. So it's 3 years between us as well. So I'm 38, 35, 32... 29, 28, 24, 23, 24. So there's near enough 3 on average. But coach him, and we didn't do very well. I don't think we won a game all year. But the kids had a load of fun, and a lot of them kids still play for the local club, which is bigger achievement for me. Is that they've stuck in the game. Their first capture is, and I remember going down the community centre every Friday night and coaching them and loving it. But again, it's committing to everybody, to help my brother, help set up a team that's seen him all the way through. That was my first role. While I was playing in Cardiff, I'd done some sports camps for Intro Teach, who set up another company called Intro Sport. So just kept my got my toes in to see if teaching and coaching, these were like summer camps, stuff like that. So any day off I had in the week, I'd go and work a day on a summer camp and stuff, and just to see what it was like and test it out. But then I coached when I went the Ospreys. I took a little bit more serious then towards the end of my career. Just coached the women's team for a series, coached an age grade team for a year. After Scott Johnson had the conversation with me about corner, what am I going to do? He allowed me to coach the Ospreys at an ABC group. The C group would train early mornings, so I was in with the C group a lot before I took the role at Newport High. And then the Newport High role led to Dragons age grade. Again, fortunate enough, because Newport High was the base of the Dragons Academy, I could help out with the kicking and the Byron A stuff some days there. And just coach as much as I could alongside running the Newport High Junior Academy, coaching a team in the college league. It was just as much as I could do, learn as much as I could. And then fortunately a role came up with the Scarlets then, a kicking coach role for the academy, linking with a senior team. And that was when I decided to go back into rugby.
So was there a particular moment then? Because again, it's so obvious that curiosity is just ingrained in you to learn, to put yourselves in environments, and to piece everything together. When you got involved with the Scarlet setup, what was there a moment there that really made you think, yeah, this is where I want to be?
Just being sat in an office with like-minded people. So I remember my first day, I think, at the Scarlets was the same day as Wayne Pivac's first day. In the office was Mark Jones, Simon Easterby, Byron Hayward. A very close friend of mine now, works for England as an analyst, Joey Lewis, who sat next to me at a table. But I really enjoyed like Mark's curiosity to learn. Mark was out and out attack coach, but would constantly dive into my understanding of the kicking game because he wanted to develop his knowledge of a kicking game. And he would always ask me questions, and like versa, I could ask him any sort of question, and he'd share openly and honestly everything he sort of learned. But Joey was like the negotiator between it as well. And what have you heard? What did Mark just say? And I'm sure he was very similar to Mark. And like Joey's a great teacher. And there's no surprise he's worked with England for X amount of years. But just being around where there's coaching the kickers on a field, the first group of kickers were like Rhys Priestland, Steve Shingler. Being around the kicking group who were very like-minded, and that transitioned to people like Patchell, Dan Jones, Angus O'Brien, the Halfpenny, like-minded people. Mm. So there was that, shit, this feels like home. These are my people. Does that make sense?
Definitely. And did that... I'm interested in that curiosity piece. Did they come with their own curiosity as well, the players? And is that the like-mindedness that you're talking about? Or are they just that thirst and that hunger to be the best they can be? And they all sound, from the outside, they all appear incredibly committed professionals as well, which would have resonated with your philosophy.
Yeah, it does. And they do come with questions. You can see there's a curiosity of the game. What can we do differently? How can we be better individually and collectively? And one of my philosophies now when we recruit, you've got to do your sort of background checks, but also you need to spend time with that person before you sign them. And what can they give back? That's a big thing I was looking at. Give back. How can you help the next generation? If you're the next generation, what do you want to learn off the future, of the past? So if we signed a Steph Hughes with an Iron Owen, combining them two will help us get better because you've got like-minded people who just want to grow.
How do you have those conversations if you're with a young player and there's a potential for a contract that's on the table? And I'm not asking you to name any names, don't worry. But how do you have that conversation with a young player to work them out, you know, to understand their values and to understand maybe if they are a right fit on and off the pitch for the squad you're building? How do you have those difficult conversations?
It's time, isn't it? You've got to spend time with people. So you've got to put the time in. You've got to build a relationship of trust so that they know that, firstly, you're going to be there when they need you, so they can open up and feel safe around you. And then suddenly you'll figure out the person that's in front of you. And you'll get good people who will always give back and work. And sometimes you don't get like-minded people. Not to say they're bad people. You just don't get like-minded people who may have different ways around it. And then, you know, as a leader now, suddenly I want a lot of like-minded people because I believe in the way things should be done correctly, and I'll go after and recruit them types of people. And again, it goes back to like references off close people to them, trying to get environments they're in. So whether you're trying to sign, use a Dan Lydiate, for example, this summer, I didn't just sign Dan Lydiate because I met him once. I signed Dan Lydiate because a lot of people who know Dan Lydiate spoke extremely highly of not only his performances, speak out now for himself, but the work he does in-house at the Ospreys to give back to the next generation and the curiosity Dan has to further his career and last longer in the game.
That links into something you said earlier as well around you're constantly kind of seeking advice, you're asking people's opinions, you're not, and it comes across to me that you're not asking people's opinions to do your job. You're simply asking them to get a different perspective, to challenge your own thinking, perhaps, and also then to add value to what you're doing. And that feels like it's a huge part of your philosophy as well.
Yeah, it is. One of my probably blind spots, I'm quite stubborn. So if you ask anyone who's extremely close to me, or like naturally, whether it's because of my background or the way I am, but I'm quite stubborn. And if I believe in something, so I'll stick with it. So I do really open myself up to be proven wrong because I like it when people defend what they believe in. So whether that's working with the new board of the Dragons, going, nah, this is the way, and I'm going, nah, this is the way. I really enjoy like-minded people, but I also open myself up to listen. I do think I'm a good listener because I'm quite reflective then to go, right, I know my feeling's this, but that doesn't mean it's right. If four people are saying it's this, it's more likely to be this. So I need to open myself up for my development and perhaps listen and let's trial and error it.
So that would I'm wondering whether that mirrors, again, you talk about that recruitment and working with players, because your self-awareness is clearly super high. You can have a little smile and a giggle about saying you're really stubborn, but then in the same breath be able to say, well, I know I am. This is what I do to address it, because ultimately I don't know everything. And that's an incredible quality. Is self-awareness something you look for in working with players and the coaching staff as well?
Massive. And I keep challenging, especially my staff, to know their blind spots, to know themselves. I think before you can master most things, you need to know yourself. You need to know. One of my best educations, I've probably spoken here publicly a few times, is going to Google for a couple of days, learning just how, there's a good story. Do you know where the term penny drop moments come from? Do you know the story behind the penny? So your best thinking time where the penny drops, basically. Oh, I get it now. So the penny drop moments when you sit on a chair like I'm on now, put a penny between your legs, squeeze your knees together, go to sleep. And then as you're falling asleep, you relax, penny will drop, hit the floor. That's when you're in your best thinking state. So that's where the term penny drop has come from, the penny drop moment. It's because it's from a state of thinking where you're at your best, deepest thinking. So you're half asleep, you're half awake, but you're in just thinking. So that's where I know I get my best ideas. So if I got a big meeting tomorrow and I need to sell a message of a kicking game, but I want to do it creatively, I'll half fall asleep next to my son as I'm putting him to bed, knowing I'm going deliberately thinking about this now. And that's where I get my best ideas, as crazy as it sounds. But I know that. So I'll purposely put that time aside in the evening to plan tomorrow's meeting. Same with, I know I'm a night person. So there's three types of, you get your traditional 9-to-5 that people think everyone should be, but there's three types of people. You get your morning people, do their best work in the morning. I'm quite alert in the morning, so it's my best work and maybe my best active time. Middle of the day, I'm useless, so I just love to get coaching. But I'll try not to sit on a laptop. I'll have a can of Coke about 2 o'clock to get me through till 4 o'clock. But then I'll come home, relax with the family in the evenings when I get my work done. But I know that because I've learned that about myself and I've studied things that they taught me there about the three different types of people. So what I like about Google is they open their office 24/7. Because most offices are 9-to-5.
Right.
But only 1/3 of your staff will be a 9-to-5 person.
That is fascinating. And I wonder how many other people have spent time. We probably haven't. Everyone's life's so busy. A lot of people have just got to do their jobs. They're not in that state of being curious, ultimately, about how they work and how they can get that optimum performance. And when you say phrases like optimum performance, you naturally think of elite sport, but it's just day-to-day life, isn't it? I'm really glad you cleared that up as well, because I don't know if I see you falling asleep on the bench for, 89 minutes with a line out in a opposition 22, I know you're thinking about the last play to win the game. So that's really good to know. What about some of those kind of inspirations? Who are those coaching inspirations, if you have any, that you kind of look to? Who have you studied in the past? Have you spent time with any? You've mentioned a few in your Scarlets days and, of course, with Cardiff, but maybe those you haven't worked directly with. Who do you take inspiration from?
People talk about mentors all the time. That's a phrase that coach educators love. And I think it's down to the coach. I speak to multiple people from multiple different industries to get the best learning I can get. So I struggle with some coach educators. I'll go, right, I'm going to give you these two mentors. You pick one. It's like absolute rubbish. I'm going to speak to 6 different people about the same thing and get 6 different opinions so I can come together and make the one that I think. I'm going to speak to him because I know he's really good deep, deliberate thinking model. But I'm going to speak to him because he's quite a creative human being. And speak to him because he's under pressure. He's got a real pressure job. So actually, if I think pressure, it's not that much. And again, it comes back to just being really active with your own development. How can I be the best I can be? It's not by having one guy about a million things. And I think sometimes that's where coach education in Wales, from experience I've seen, more in sport, lets yourself down. It's like one shoe doesn't fit all, and you've got to put the pressure on. It goes back to the word I love using, self-reliant. You've got to make, if you want to create a really good coach, make him self-reliant, because he'll go and solve problems. If you want to make a really good player, make him self-reliant. If you want to make a really good student, make him self-reliant. If they don't do the work, they'll never be good.
And
they'll...
And absolutely. And there's only so much you can do for people, isn't there? That leads me nicely to a bit that has kind of come across my desk, so to speak. You know, you go to interviews and, you know, you probably have conversations like this. You can say, so what would people say about you? What would your players say about you, Di, as a head coach? Personally, I hate that question because it comes across as, oh, well, I'm brilliant, I'm this, I'm that. And very much I like the idea of speak to people that I've worked with. That's the best way to get the impression. You're clearly so self-aware in your personal development there. So was a bit proactive and spoke to someone close to you, where no names, but you probably work it out. And I found it very interesting what they said, because you just talked there about trust, trusting the players, trusting yourself, the staff, the advice you get. And I asked this person the couple of questions really related to you as a coach. And they said, so when asked for someone close to you for their opinion, I often think of what Damien Hughes says on the High Performance Pod. If my child was to be coached by ex-coach, would I be comfortable? And the answer with Flan is undeniably yes. And this is the bit that really hit for me, which I love, is Di's ability to build trust is unparalleled. I don't know how he does it, but he has a knack for it. It's why I think he'll be an excellent head coach. And they also followed up with, they'll probably be really embarrassed if you read that out to them. So naturally I had to do it, not to embarrass you, but I think just to emphasise everything you've said and clearly what a leader you are and those diligent pieces of work that you commit to. What does it feel like hearing something like that from someone that you've coached?
No, it's brilliant, isn't it? You know, I'm a big believer in the world's built on trust. I give trust quite easy, but once you break it, and again, I know one of my weaknesses as a person, and some people tell me it's good. My family think I need to ease back and give second chances a bit more. It's once you break my trust, it's hard to get it back because I give it so easy. Because if someone trusts me, they can trust me. So when I give trust, I expect the same back. And if people could describe me, what I would like to be described, that is just honest, hardworking, and trustworthy. I think three values in life that you can get as far as you want to if you've got them three things.
I think that's really, really clear that is what people think about you. So it's a really exciting head coach journey you're on at the moment. Talking of head coaches, talking of coaching idols, another shared passion that like-minded that me and you have is a certain Mr. Ted Lasso. And I'm really pleased and delighted, I think, not just pleased, delighted you're wearing the AFC Richmond colours this evening with pride. Just tell us a little bit about, for those that are listening who, for some weird reason, haven't seen Ted Lasso, you know, just give us a little flavour around why you've connected with him as a head coach, his role, how he looks after people. And is there anything within that you've picked up and maybe transferred into your coaching philosophy?
I like his curiosity first. So he's come into a sport he knows nothing about. So it does reminds me of me a little bit without speaking. My first coaching gig was at the Scarlets kicking coach. Unfortunately, Mark Jones left three quarters of the way through the year. I had to step in front of a group under Wayne and lead the attack with a room full of Regan King, Rhys Priestland, Scott Williams, Liam Williams, Gareth Davis, who played at a much higher level than I've ever played at. So I had to open myself up. I had to build trust with our group that I can help them. And we had to win X amount of games to the end of the season. Otherwise, we wouldn't have qualified for Europe. And I remember my first meeting was very clear of like, I'm here to facilitate the knowledge in the room. If Regan King sat in the room, one of the best players ever played Welsh rugby, regional rugby. Mm. I'm going to dive into your brain to help everyone in this room. And to do that, I needed to be curious to what's in there. I needed to listen and understand. And I loved that part. It was a great opportunity for me to learn, step back and reflect. And you can see that with when you watch the show Ted Lasso, he doesn't know the rules of football, but he can get out the group. But he teaches life lessons along the way as well, little things like be a goldfish and brilliant. So a massive NFL fan as well, and I love the quarterback position because you might throw one interception. 5 minutes later, you're thrown again, so you've got to move on. So there's life lessons throughout, and I think would I like to be coached by Ted? I'd bloody love it, because he'd be questioning, quizzing, challenging. So the show's great, isn't it? I've got my son into it now, so in certain parts of it I won't let him watch, but the lessons along the way, and it's entertainment, but if you dive deep enough into it, there's learning throughout there as well.
100%, yeah. I think I'm on series two for the third time now. I think it's and I don't get bored of it. The bit for me, be curious, not judgmental. The Walt Whitman quote, the famous one in series one. That landed with me, and that's what I kind of use to drive what we're doing with Speakeasy, and just constantly be curious and learn a little bit. I love that phrase you just used though, that facilitating the knowledge in the room. That is. Again, that's a very self-aware thing. You know, yeah, you mentioned the names that were in the changing room at the time, but that's ultimately having incredible ability and confidence in yourself to harness everything that everyone's done. Was it just took me through a little bit more about that. Can you explain a little bit more about how you would go about facilitating the knowledge in a room?
So I like quite active, loud meetings. It might go against a lot of what coaches potentially like, but the louder the meeting, the more conversations in the meeting, the more debate in the meeting, the better. More people feel comfortable. So one of my lessons I have whenever I've tried to run a real productive meeting, if you're on a field, you warm up, you stretch your muscles, you get physically ready to train. But we sit in a meeting and we as a teacher or a coach stand at the front and start talking. So by the time I've spoken for 5 minutes, the group are quiet. They're like, will you hurry up? Always going to speak, so you always need to start the meeting with a bang. You need a discussion, you need a debate, you need people to feel comfortable, and suddenly leave the music on in a meeting, leave it simmering so they're comfortable to talk while things are on, so then when you ask them a question, it's not, oh, I'm the only one speaking here. They've already spoken, they've shared an idea, which means they're in a safe zone to present their idea. So there's little things I constantly do to get that out of them. Coaching, teaching isn't about what I know. Like a myth, and coming from an education background, it's great that teachers are specialists in their subject, but their job's not for them to be the specialists, it's to get the information across into the kids so they can be better. Mm. And that's my job. I know I don't know everything, and I try to learn something every day off my playing group, and it's great, like when I get Angus O'Brien coming up with an idea about a kickoff setup, or I get a forward come at me going, oh, you can use me better because I'm better at this, and then I go, right, show me. I constantly, because it's not, again, it's not about what I know, it's about what I can teach the group and get them the level they can get to. So that was a big learning for me from day one. It's like I couldn't stand in front of a group who were way in advance of playing career than me as a young coach. I think I was only 28 at the time, coaching 35-year-olds. They were the coaches. I was just writing notes and giving them a platform to present to the others to get us where we needed to go.
It's an incredibly empowering approach as well, don't you think? That, you know, if you're constantly showing as the head coach, as the leader of the group, that you're prepared to essentially be vulnerable at times, and I appreciate there's ways to do it appropriately and there's ways to do it, that it goes back to your ultimate philosophy of helping the players to be self-reliant, because they can see you as the leader doing that constantly and checking, challenging and working with the coaching staff. And then that must really empower them to be able to do that on and off the pitch as well.
Yeah, I'm very well aware the buck always stops with the coach. But there's a saying I love to say in meetings, like, it's great to disagree, but we need to commit. So what I'll set up is a potentially a room of conflict, because I want to hear everyone's thoughts, but we will align then. And it might not be that day. So you might present something on a Monday and go, right, because I love a corridor conversation. I remember I presented on an elite coaching program. I won't say the head coach I presented to, but I presented my philosophy and how I run meetings. And he fully disagreed with me. He hated, he said, any meeting you step into, you need to finish the meeting. Well, I disagree, because there'll be six players at the back room who might not speak in that meeting and might have the best idea. They might walk out the room, go to one of the leaders and say, what about this? Suddenly it generates more thinking, the corridor conversation can come back to the day after meeting with a better idea, and then we can commit. But sometimes like to leave meetings not early in the week, but once we decide we commit to something, we commit. So I'm very well aware the buck will always stop with the coach, and there's always a time and place for tell. I don't think it's in the problem solving in this areas, but I think when you're it's in the conflict areas of more the one-to-one meetings, the behaviour stuff, the little rules you set, that's black and white. If you want culture to really advance, well, the standards you have set. But when we come to teaching the game and development of people, the book should be open constantly.
It just screams of setting those boundaries for everybody, and everyone knows that, you know, they're not prescriptive, they're not restrictive, but there are those boundaries that when you get to that point, right, we're committing now, and that everybody's had their chance as well. I think gives that freedom and goes back to the empowerment as well, doesn't it? It's a really, really exciting way to approach a group.
Lovely.
Last question, just before I let you go, I really appreciate your time. So the name of this podcast is In the Clubhouse. It's ultimately about, where's that safe place? Where's that place that you kind of go to? It doesn't have to be bricks and mortar. It can be just a place that you feel really comfortable. It could be a group of people. It doesn't need to be a single place. But we've had some really interesting definitions of people's clubhouses. So that is my final question to you. Di Flanagan, where is your clubhouse?
How long do I have to answer this? If I start with, so my life had a bit of trauma when I was young. Oh, we lost my brother outside the house, got run over, unfortunately, in front of me. When I was 15, he was 7. I don't think the family would have got through it if it weren't for the clubhouse.
Okay.
So Penalty Rugby Club, the people there, first and foremost, gathering around us, and talks about protection. So they sort of put us in the middle and protected us as a family. Yeah, so the clubhouse is obviously the clubhouse. My life's built around it. I can't do much enough to help it out going forward. So the clubhouse. Yeah, as cheesy as that might sound, the rugby club is the place where if I take my ball, I want to go down on the field, kick a ball with him, because it brings back the memories of how they protected the family at that time. They couldn't do enough for us. They couldn't do enough for me. One of my brightest memories through that period was, I talk about like Martin Rowe, Richard Rowe, Matthew Tucker, the older youth boys. I was 15. They come pick me up, took me for a game of snooker about 10 days after the death, and just got me back to normality. So the clubhouse, Penalty Rugby Club, is the place.
My instinct is to say I love that story and an analogy. Of course, it's been kind of born out of that trauma, and so sorry to hear that. And it is though a great example of something out of adversity being a real, real positive step. And I'm the same. It's not cheesy. My clubhouse is my rugby club, the Open Arthians, and I know exactly what you mean about that safety and putting you in the middle and looking after you. So that's brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. I said that was the last question. I have got one more, I'm afraid. You mentioned earlier, and we didn't actually get into it, there was a bit of advice from your father back in the day that you always remember, and we didn't actually get onto it. So I just wanted to ask you what that piece of advice was.
So there's a couple of building sites on the valleys that I'll drive in the car with the kids and go, Dad built that house. Well, my dad's a builder, so he's done it the tough way. He's been on site his whole life, worked his ass off to get provide for the family. And I just remember summers I'd go in and work a couple of weeks with him, labouring for him, stacking bricks. And I loved it because of the camaraderie on site and stuff. And also you feel like you've done a day's work because you're shattered that evening and then you get up in the morning after. And it taught a lot of life lessons. But I remember one Christmas school holiday, and it must have been minus a million outside. And I told my dad, I'm coming to work with you tomorrow. Probably about 14, 15 years old. Maybe not far after Luke's death, maybe 15, 16. I'm coming to work with you tomorrow. Yeah, I'll help you out. So we've gone to work. every breeze block is cutting my hand to shreds. I'm picking block after block of stack for him. He's there smoking a fag, watching me do it, pretending to lay bricks, but nothing would set because it was too cold. I broke. What the effing hell are we doing here? It's effing freezing. I want to go home. And he goes, get in the car then. Sat in the car and he said, all right, if you don't pay attention in school and if you don't work hard enough at stuff you love, you'll be on site with me in weather like this. And it's just one of them moments you're like, for a fun-loving guy who probably people think don't take things serious, the lessons he taught us as kids, awesome.
I love that. That's such an important message, I think, to finish on. And again, ultimately how it shaped you and impacted you moving forward in your career. So, yeah, I love that one. That's a great place to finish. Di, again, just thanks so much for your time, mate. Really appreciated it. I've got about 500 more questions I'm going to pester you with over the season just to pick away at a few of those things. But again, thank you for your insights. Thanks for your honesty and thanks for sharing your clubhouse as well. Very, very best luck for the season. And we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you very much.
We really hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as we did. We certainly took a lot away from it, and it's important to us to hear your feedback. Let us know what you think. Please leave a review, leave us a rating, and it would mean an awful lot to us to hear your feedback. Please stick with us. We look forward to welcoming you soon back into the clubhouse. And it's really exciting, some of the guests we've got coming up for the rest of the series. So I'll leave you with one question. I'm sure you can guess what it is. And that one question is, where is your clubhouse? See you soon.